Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to talk about Mayan EDMS, a document management system that does end-to-end stuff. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 253, recorded May 29th, 2013. Mayan EDMS. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week, or as often as I can, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, the projects you might not have heard of, the projects you may be using every day. As always, I am accompanied by a wonderful co-host, no exception this week, Dan Lynch. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Very cool, Dan. And where are you speaking to us from? We never get enough of that in this show.
We don't, do we? I know our guest's in a very exotic location today. I'm not in quite such an exotic location. I'm in Liverpool, which is in the north of England. And of course, people will now go, oh, do you know the Beatles? That's the question I get quite a lot. I'm afraid I don't know any of them. That's where I am, right up in the northwest of England, of the UK.
And of those of you that are watching the video may notice a slightly different background for me this week as well. I am working for Captain Neil of Insight Cruises. He occasionally brings me out to do some more work on his websites and make everything go faster for him. And so if you hear a little bit of noise in the background, I'm actually in a residential place here. And so there might be like cuckoo clocks going off or phone calls going on. I have no idea what kind of sounds I'm going to hear. Maybe birds chirping outside. So sorry for a little bit of background noises for the show, but hopefully there won't be too many interruptions because we have a great show. Our guest today is, let me look for his name there, Roberto Rosario. And he is the proprietor of creator and head honcho for the Mayan EDMS, which is an what does EDMS stand for? I don't even have it on my notes. It's some document management.
Electronic document management.
Yeah, and that's why we have you around to remind me of how this goes. And so I did a little bit of studying of it before the show, but it's basically sort of an end-to-end solution where you scan documents in and you add some metadata for them. And then you can look them up, and then you can also, I think it even has like OCR, so you're able to like get the electronic version of the text in the document. So it sounds like a pretty interesting project, sort of end-to-end project. What do you know about this so far, Dan?
I've just had a quick look at it, but it does look really, really interesting. And I think it's one of these problems. I mean, so many organizations, particularly governments, health service and so on, I used to work for the health service, I know was buried under the weight of paper debt records. So if we can start getting those into a digital system that works and it's free software and open source, all the better.
So let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Roberto Rosario. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Randall, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Doing well. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm from right now in San Juan, Puerto Rico, in the capital city.
I've been there quite a few times. I actually enjoy the city, the old town, the numerous bars in Old Town, all sorts of things like that. Oh, we've been there on cruise ships, so we've been there for like during a day. But I've also been over to Arecibo a couple times, which has been a lot of fun. So we got some backstage tours of Arecibo. I actually got to go to where the engineers actually work. And I've actually been under the dish and touched the dish in Arecibo.
Yeah, that's awesome. I haven't been able to touch the dish, and I live here. Have you been to the caverns?
Right. Been to the what, sorry?
To the cavern system.
Okay, yeah.
It's a stone throw from the Arecibo dish. You should be there. You should go there. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like fun. Next time I'll go there, I'll try to check that out. Cool. All right. Well, that's enough this week in tourism. Let's get back to what the show is actually about. We've got you on to talk about Mayan EDMS. I gave sort of an overview of that at the beginning of the show, but you want to go ahead and give us like the 30,000-foot view of what it is and what problem it solves?
Yeah, it's a document management system. It was born out of the necessity of the government of Puerto Rico when we switched to an all digital processing system in 2010, and we didn't have much of an idea how to manage electronic documents. So with what little I knew at the time, I set about the task to build a document management system fit for the needs of the government at the time.
And so what is a document management system, just so everybody can come up with the same page here?
Well, basically, it allows you to get rid of your electronic archive, your physical archives, and digitize all your documents, blueprints, paper, receipts. And aside from managing the digital documents, it's very useful because it keeps all the metadata of all the documents. So you get a lot of contextual information about how the documents relate to each other. So in a sense, I will have to say it's the microfilm of the 21st century.
So did I just hear that you're doing this for the government?
Well, initially it was for the government of Puerto Rico, but I'm a big fan of open source and free software, and I said, let's throw it out to the internet, see if anyone else might get any use out of this. And it was a huge boom. It's translated to... It's now in 15 languages. It's grown in size exponentially. Now it's 30,000 lines of code. It does OCR, metadata, indexing, tagging. And thanks to the community, it's gone to places I never even dreamed it would go.
Well, clearly, if any organization needs a management of documents, it's got to be government. What's been the reception of people who have to use something like this? Is it better than stacking paper on shelves and then trying to find that later in boxes, or is it totally replacing that, or something in between?
It's actually replacing that, and it's allowing you to do completely new things you couldn't do with physical archives, like linking documents using the API to other case management systems, for example, is one of the big uses the government is employing Mayan for. There's a lot of talks about plugging Mayan into our new health information exchange infrastructure, for example. And a document management system, as one as Mayan, which is so encompassing right now, it starts to cross the boundaries of document management system and starts to go into electronic record management, knowledge base systems, and content management system. So all those areas, there's a little bit of overlap in such. So anytime you need to organize large volumes of data, a document management system is usually the kind of software that you need.
So you mentioned OCR earlier. How effective is that, and what's the basis of the open source component of that, or what software are you using to do that?
Well, the software, the default software is Tesseract from Google. I think HP started it, and Google took over the project. It's actually very reliable, and it comes with training files for some 10, 15 languages by default, but you can train it to another any kind of language you want. The OCR system right now is in the stage of being pluggable. So in the future, you might want to, if you want to use your own OCR software, be it free or purchase one, a proprietary one, you may be able to do that. Aside from the OCR, everything else is free software. It's built on Python, and on top of Python, it's using Django. And it's using some 25 free libraries.
And using all those free libraries, was that a great advantage in developing this? Like, how much original work did you have to do to glue that all together?
Well, the code base right now is 30,000 lines. Using mm-hmm. Counting the libraries, it will get to about 50,000 lines. So I would say that half the work was... bus going out and fetching the libraries and deciding which one I wanted to use, which one were the most stable ones. And as being true to the mantra of Richard Stallman, I just stood up on the shoulders of giants, and that made the work a lot less complex and much more manageable. Because, for example, the indexing system is using a balanced tree system, which I have no idea how to work out. and using the libraries, the existing libraries, just makes it possible to add a whole bunch of features that you yourself wouldn't be able to implement on your own. So that's where the advantages of free software really shines through.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot too with my project that I've had to do. It's really nice to be able to pull down a library that just does what I want it to do and not have to go read up on how to write the algorithms for that. I never went to formal computer science school, so I don't I only kind of barely understand how a compiler works. I can sort of work my way through it about how it works. I'm so glad I could just type GCC and have it work, because otherwise I would be in a lot of trouble all these days. So that's pretty cool. You mentioned earlier, so you got health records and other government documents. I've got to wonder about security and authentication. How is that handled?
The authentication by default uses the Django authentication system, but because Django in itself provides a pluggable system, you can replace that by anything you want. For example, the government of Puerto Rico is using, because the existing infrastructure is Active Directory from Microsoft, we build a abstraction layer for that, and we authenticate our users, again, our existing index directory services. And in terms of security, Mayan has a very sophisticated and rather complex permission system where anything that you want to do, any action that you want to do, is governed by a permission. You can assign the permission by groups, by users, or by users for any specific document. So, for example, I can give you permission to see the management records, but you don't have permission to see anything about accounting. I can give you permissions per document in the accounting office, for example. I can give permissions by roles. I can assign you to a temporary role where you inherit the permission, and as soon as you feel that your work is finished, I take you out of the of that role, and the permission you don't have it anymore. So the permission system is very granular. It's been a very good fit. Everybody likes it, and it's being expanded as we talk. For example, we are working now in a workflow system where the permissions you assign to a user are actually dependent on the state a document might be. So you might have permissions to upload a document, and you cannot do anything with that document until a supervisor approves it for circulation in the office. Then you get, again, the read and write permission for that document.
And again, a similar area to the security issue is the electronic signing of documents. I mean, you don't want to have to print it out on hard copy just to put a signature on it and then record it back in. Do you have ways of doing authenticated signatures on documents?
Yes. Right now, I'm using GNU Pretty Good Privacy with very good results. Because the actual action of signing a document is something of a patent minefield for implementation of how you... Yes, it's actually really ridiculous. I don't know how companies have managed to get patents on how to not so much about the algorithms, but the user actions required to sign the documents are actually patented. So for now, users wanting to sign documents for use with Mayan have to sign the documents outside the software, but the software does do signature validation of documents.
Cool. That's interesting that you said the patents were getting in the way of doing this. That seems really sad, actually. So how did you manage to steer through that? You have something that's similar but not patentable?
Well, the software does signature verification but doesn't provide any means to sign the documents until I'm sure I can come up with a series of steps in the UI that doesn't step on anybody else's patents. So it's kind of like the Polaroid patent. They managed to get a patent about the actual idea of instantaneous photography instead of getting the patent about the chemical process for instant photography. So digital signatures they get patents on the algorithm and the implementation and the actual user experience for signing the document.
Okay, so Roberta, I'm interested in why you chose to use Django and Python. Django is a well-known Python web framework. I'm a big fan of it, but it wouldn't strike me as an obvious choice for a document management system. I don't know if that's just me being short-sighted. So what was it about Django? Was it something that you already knew, or you saw something in it that you thought was good for this?
My choice of using Django was because I wanted to start from day zero with a web app. And being a developer of Python, I knew how good the language was. And what struck me most of the Django community was the commitment to quality code. If something is ambiguous and can be done in two or three ways, the community chooses not to impose one method of doing stuff. A good example of that is database migrations. They completely steer away from that until one mechanism that fits everybody's needs is found. That, on top of the code quality, was that what drove me to use Django. I wanted to build a software which is in itself steer to very mission critical environments. So I wanted to use a language and a framework that took itself as serious as I was taking the project.
Excellent. And what you mentioned that Python was a language that you knew. So what's your history with Python? You've done a lot of Python development in the past.
Yes, I started working with Python very soon after I started working after I discovered Linux in 1996, 1997, and just became a huge fan of this idea that the language as I was using was actually evolving as I was using it, and that anybody could post a request for features and a comment on what they like and didn't like. And I love that idea.
Yeah, and I noticed that your project is actually licensed under GPL v3, which seems like an interesting choice of license. So what was the thinking behind that?
I wanted to protect the code I wanted to make the code free as much as I could and protect it itself from any forks or any issue that might come on in the future, because document management system is a very profitable market. I knew that as soon as I released the software, there was going to be a little bit of a struggle between the established software in the market. It's a very small market, but the margins are very huge. My initial idea was not to make a commercial product, was just to solve our own local project a problem. But as the project grew, I knew that a viable product, I might start to want to fork and appropriate the product or undermine the original free project.
And I was interested that you used the GPL rather than the AGPL or the Affero GPL to give it its full title, because that's kind of designed for web software. One of the problems that I'm sure not everyone's as much of a licensing geek as I am, but when it comes to the GPL, the GNU GPL, one of the problems was that in this networked world that we live in, everything seems to be a web service these days. Under the old GPL, there wasn't really a way of using copyleft and so on to make people share their code in the same way. So the Affero GPL tried to get around this by having an extra clause in there which requires a web application to print out its own source code to have a function to do that. So did you look at that, or did you decide you wanted the GPL rather than the AGPL? Was that a conscious thing?
Yeah, it was a conscious thing, but I've been asking for comments from the community if they think that we should actually start relicensing the software from the next version onwards. And to my surprise, the community's reaction was to just keep it as it is. They really like the choice of being able to use any component of the software as they want and just keep building on top of it. So Maya has become, in the document management system, this beacon of it's actually the only free software, the only completely free software in this market. So the community has become very protective of it. And as I've become with the same mythology of Django to really think through every decision that is going to be made, and licensing decisions are going to be very, very well thought out. But my personal opinion is that maybe we should switch to a less restrictive licenses like Ademero or Fero.
Okay, yeah. And you mentioned the community there and interacting with the community, which is something we're always really interested in on this show. So what's your kind of community size like? And what about things like governance? Are you the benevolent dictator or is there like a team involved or a foundation even? How does all that work?
Well, as I say, this project just grew exponentially beyond my wildest dreams. So I've been learning about community management and community outreach as I did the project. Initially, I just created a Google group so that users that were fans of the software could help each other, and I could have a little bit more of a direct communication, not just email. I don't mind emails, but the problem with emails is if I tell someone how to fix something, that knowledge is restricted to just to that person. So I wanted a more open approach, and that's why I started doing the Google group, so that the knowledge of how to deal with things could remain behind and a knowledge base could start to be formed. From that Google group, a lot of developers starting to join in and started to submit ideas, patches. And when we had the little bit of a licensing issue, I realized that the project has outgrown the moniker of a little project. It became really a community project, and I asked the community what they would like if the project if they wanted me to continue steering the project, or if a foundation should be established and for me to hand over the copyrights and all the rights to the software. And the response was 50-50. A lot of people want me to continue doing the project. They feel that it's still not mature enough for it to be under the steering committee of a foundation. And they feel that I can still contribute a lot, especially in the technical sense. The other half that were of the opinion to hand over the project to a foundation were of the opinion to do that in the future also. So for now, I'm the benevolent dictator or the temporary dictator of the project, but I hope that to hand over the control of the project in the future, not too soon.
And how many people are working on this right now? I mean, you're getting patches from the community. It sounds like you've got a lot of stuff going on. But do you have like a core dev team, or is it really just kind of open to everyone?
Yes, it's a core dev team. But code submissions are not a big part of the submissions I get. I don't know if I try to document everything as much as possible, but the way I do things apparently are not obvious to some people, and people tend to submit the most amount of help I get is in documentation, testing, feature requests, bug fixes, and bug reports. The actual code submission is very low, and that's something I'm trying to figure out why. Is it the code documentation? Is it the code structure? So that's why I'm doing this kind of hybrid release system in which one release I focus on user experience, and the next release I focus on developer experience. So in one release, I try to improve the UI, and in the next release, in an alternate manner, I try to improve the logistics of the internal code. So that is, it is more readable and more easy to understand in hopes to promote code submission.
So how is this organized in terms of, you've got a lot of large data, a lot of pictures and images and things, and you must have some sort of database behind the scenes to manage all the metadata. And how do you have that organized on disk and in the metadata so you can find all the stuff quickly?
Well, because I didn't want it to commit to a specific infrastructure. Mayan has the peculiar property that is basically just a bunch of abstraction layers on top of each other. So the storage system in itself is just a layer, it's a driver. The core system, the core document system, doesn't do anything having to, with storage. It just calls the storage function. So by default, it comes with disk storage and GridFS storage, which is the file system of the MongoDB database. But if you plug in any of the existing Django storage drivers, you can start storing documents from a local Maya installation to have it completely store the documents offsite in, say, Amazon or by FTP. So the idea with Maya was to abstract as much as possible everything. So the knowledge of how to actually interact with stuff is enclosed, is encapsulated in small, smart classes. So in that sense, it's Python, but takes a lot of ideas from, say, Java, for example. In to handle the large amount of data that is usually stored in a document management system, I didn't want to follow the established paradigms of just imitating the desktop and having folders. So Mayan has the unique capability that actually sorts out how to organize documents by itself to create a sort of a template of how documents are going to be organized in relation to each other based on the metadata, writing expressions, Python expressions. And as soon as you start uploading the documents based on their metadata and based on the this template that you build, Maya will start organizing all the documents by itself. So there's once you upload a document, there's very little manual work that you have to do. And that's one of the things that sets Maya apart from other document management systems.
Yeah, I'm sort of curious about that, actually, because I know that in document storage systems, especially with government stuff, you're going to want to have views into the data that span all of history, everything that you know about in the system. But you're also going to want to have views that are much more topical, like all the things, the unanswered email for the last 3 months or something like that. You know, that sort of narrowing view. Can you set up both of those kinds of views?
Yes, you can actually have documents appear in more than one view, for example, based mm-hmm. on the metadata. If, for example, in the governor of Puerto Rico, they're using it to handle blueprints and permits. So a specific document might be part of a permit request, while at the same time, it might be part of a construction project, while on the same time, it might be part of an investigation into a violation of zoning laws, for example. So one document can be part of many views.
And is there a way also to have metadata for documents that aren't scanned into the system but are just sitting in a box somewhere that you want to have some knowledge that it is available even though it's not in the system?
Yes, you can store documents in Mayan, or you can use Mayan as a catalog for a physical archive. It's one of the many uses that for example, lawyers tend to use it that way because they can scan the document, but they cannot destroy the original document. So they use the digital copy for quick browsing or for references, and they store in that digital document the metadata of where the physical document is actually located. So you can use Mayan as an index for a large physical file, for example.
Well, that really opens up a lot of other uses. What's the most unusual use that you've heard so far for Mayan?
Well, I would have to say as a photo archiving system, I have no idea the people could actually want to use that as a local substitute for, say, stock photography website. And because Mayan is file format agnostic, I've seen a lot of people also storing and indexing audio files and video files, which that was a big surprise for me. And seeing that, I might actually include multimedia previews in the future with Mayan. So aside from a document management system, it will actually evolve into a generic files management system.
Awesome. And how about cloud friendliness? So you mentioned S3 earlier, but what about just simply running the whole thing in EC2?
Yes, that was a big advantage of going free software because people already knew the software. They started to develop deployment strategies. So Mayan can be deployed in a virtual box and can be deployed in the cloud. There's one provider called AppSambler which actually provides a one-click install of Mayan in Amazon. So you go to the website, you want to try out Mayan, you just go over there, you click the one, click the install button, and you have your own instance of Mayan in their private cloud. And there are people selling appliances. There are people selling virtual appliances, customized virtual appliances using Ubuntu, for example.
Wow, that's pretty cool. In fact, I was just getting whispered in my ear, said, ask about appliance. And there we go. And there you are. You said it. Thanks, Dan. cool. I want to go back a little bit more to your role with the Puerto Rican government. How did you get that role? And not that you don't deserve it, but how did you get that role? And how did the government agree to make this open source?
Well, they didn't exactly agree. that's a little bit of that's an interesting story, and actually a very good test case of how free software is actually very, very, very beneficial for the government. Many moons ago, I was a lonely IT guy in a regional office, and I started toying with free software to lower costs in my office. My manager was very happy with that, so he basically gave me a blank check to experiment with free software in my office. And my office kind of became the skunk works of free software in the government. And as more and more approval, I managed to get more and more approval, I started to develop actually free software stuff. But to sidestep the legal requirements, I had to develop the software in my own spare time. So that's the key. You can use free software in the government, but you cannot use government time to develop the software, at least at that time. So Mayan and all my other free software government solutions are all of them developed on my own spare time. I only use government time in the actual install and implementation of any specific driver or plugin required to make the software work in the government. That was some 2 years ago. Now, thanks in a large part to Mayan, the CIO of this new government was very interested in my role trying to get free software into the government of Puerto Rico, and name me director of software development for the whole government of Puerto Rico. So I'm now in the position of actually writing policy that's helping developers, government developers, to actually use a big percent of their time to develop free software and still retain a share property on the code, specifically the copyright part. Now, with these changes, this has been a complete coin flip. Now the government of Puerto Rico is very open to the usage of free software, and Mayan is actually government policy right now. It's the go-to solution when any government agency needs document management software.
That's amazing. That's a great story, and probably can serve as a model for other people trying to get it into their governments. That'll be great. I bet the first line of the policy is Roberto can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, basically. I basically prove that free software is a no-risk decision when it comes to software in the government. Not open source, free software. It's a natural match for the things you do in the government. The government should be as free and as open as it can be. It has to be. So, for example, proprietary software usage in the government causes a big problems in terms of when you want to do code reviews, for example. Mm-hmm. Our new health information system infrastructure is based completely on free software, because I need to know how the social security and private information of people is actually being stored and transmitted in the system. And signing an AD and non-disclosure agreement to look at code is not a solution. It makes the problem worse, because now if I develop something that's even remotely similar to what I just saw, I'm liable for lawsuit, because sure. I might... I, there's the claim that I'm stealing an algorithm or something. So what my tenure here is showing is that I'm actually teaching the government that open source and free software should be the default decision when applying software to the government. And the response has been very good. For example, a good landmark of that is that the official webpage of the governor of Puerto Rico is now running on free software. It's running on Drupal. So that was awesome. a big win for us, yeah.
Awesome, yeah. And I'm not quite sure I should know this, but the relationship between Puerto Rico being a territory of the U.S. or something, whatever it's called, a possession of the U.S., are you subject to things like...
No. You cannot say that. It's a commonwealth.
A commonwealth of the U.S. I don't want to get that wrong. I know. It's not a state. It's not a possession. It's not a territory. It's a commonwealth. Does that mean you're subject to things like the U.S. rules for HIPAA and other privacy things?
Yeah, we are under the jurisdiction of a lot of U.S. policies, but we have a lot of also, because it is a friendly relationship with the United States, we also have a lot of leeway in doing, for example, minor implementation of the interpretation of a certain policy or law. A good example of that is the accessibility laws, 508, I think is the law. And mm-hmm. we have a local law, is the law 229, which actually helps implement accessibility laws in our culture. For example, there might be some specific cultural property or phenomenon where American laws might not apply. So underneath the American or the federal law, we create a local law that helps fit the mandate of the spirit of that law into our local legal system.
Interesting. And what's the open source culture like in San Juan?
Well, it's starting to bloom now. 2012 was a big year, and now with this new government that came into power, being very pro open solutions, we are seeing a lot of small communities blooming now. For example, we have for the first time a Python interest group in Puerto Rico, and we are in the process of getting it officially accepted. We have a large Ruby sort of developers community. The security communities are also increasing in size very prominently. And I just got in touch a few weeks ago with Richard Stallman. He's very interested in visiting the island now that the software development environment is much more open to free software instead of proprietary software, which was basically the norm, the rule for as far as I can remember.
And have you gone as far as, I think it's the Brazilian government? Yeah, the Brazilian government, where the Brazilian government has actually published a whole how-to guide of how to get away from Microsoft and other proprietary software and on to open source software. Is that something you've done already or thinking about doing, or did I just inspire something?
Yeah, it's in the plans, but because free software is still a very new topic for the government, we are trying to go... very slow but very steady pace. So our law project to force the usage of free software or an official policy on software migration from proprietary to free software is something that I would like to see in the future. But as things are right now, might not be successful if I go out with that kind of policy. That being said, in June 6th, we are celebrating the first Technology Summit and Software Summit, and we are doing the first government hackathon using recently open government data. So that event is going to be a good thermometer to see how the political environment is in terms of moving to a more free and soft and libre and open software requirements for the government. So we are basically touch and go at this time.
It's too bad it's just right around the corner because I could have come. I would have enjoyed to be there. So if you have one next year, be sure to invite me. I would definitely love an excuse to get out to Puerto Rico again because it's not that far away from I'm at. So and if you have any other summits, let me know too. Like I said, any excuse to get to Puerto Rico would be great. Awesome. If you want to be in touch with the guys in Brazil that did that paper for them, I've got contacts for that too.
Yeah, I would love that because it will serve us as a good template to get started eventually to release our own policy for that.
And how did you get into open source software in the first place?
I got into open source software thanks to Debian in 94. And I really miss the old days of the home computer segment where you could actually hack anything. You could create your own software. And when that segment died, the 90s were very gloomy for a software developer. You had Microsoft DOS and that was it. And I really felt that the software development community stagnated in that decade. So when a friend of mine that was working in academia told me about this new movement about giving back the freedoms to the user and to the developers, I just got hooked and just tried Debian one time and that was it. I just fell in love with it and the whole idea.
Ah, it sounds excellent. And a common story, a lot of people seem to say the same thing, that they find their way in and, you know, once they're in, we never let them go. I was curious about when I mentioned to a few people today that I was going to be talking to you in the name of the project and stuff, I'm sure it's something you get asked a lot, but people keep asking me, where's the name come from? So I thought I'd have to pass that question on to you. So why is it called Mayan and where did that come from?
It's kind of a little bit of an inside joke. I was watching the first beta of Mayan was made in a little bit of more than a week. So I just had like an hour to think about to come up with a code name for the repository on GitHub. And I was watching the Indians documentary in the History Channel. And I kept thinking to myself, these guys are so advanced. They were so scientific. I bet they could have done a much better job than our government handling this situation. So Mayan is a kind of a wink to how I think ancient cultures could still teach us a lot about organizing ourselves and doing things right in a way that could really outlast our own civilization.
Excellent. I wasn't sure where you were going to go with that answer, but that's an interesting one. I wondered where the link was. There had to be a link there somewhere. So another kind of random question that just kind of popped into my head, being a bit of a Python fan. Obviously, you're built on Python with Django and so on. We've got Python 3 now, Python 3000, I think we're supposed to call it, and that's kind of kicking off and stuff. Will that have any effect on your system, do you think? Will there be things in Python 3 that will help you or you'll be useful, or will it break anything that's coming in?
Well, I did a try with Python 3.2, I think it was the last try, and things still break a lot. I realized why the Python community had to do what they did in releasing a new point release that was not backward compatible, to not being forced to drag along incompatibilities and stuff they didn't like. But I'm still steering away from Python 3, I think. Well, I think it was a very good idea. It was a very brave thing to do. But the compatibility hurdles are still too big for people like me with mission-critical software to start experimenting with Python 3, I think. So I'm holding that off until the conversion tools are much more mature or there are a lot of more knowledge of how to port Python 2.0, 2.7 applications to Python 3000.
Yeah, it's still one of those things that's kind of up in the air at the moment. It's the big thing that's going on in the Python community right now. And another kind of pet love of mine in the Python world is PyPy. So I have to ask you, have you looked at PyPy? Do you know about it at all?
Are
you into it?
That's a project I'm very, very, very excited about. The idea of just optimizing your code by just switching the compiler just blows my mind. And the fact that now Python is a self-hosting is one of the the big landmarks in any software, in any language, and in any compiler and operating system is when it becomes self-hosted, you can say that the software is really mature and you can call it enterprise ready. So PyPI and the other initiatives are very attracted to me. I started to playing with PyPI and Mayan, still a little bit of stuff breaks, but it's because Mayan uses a lot of low-level Python stuff. But in the future, I might try to abstract those functions too, and hopefully get Mayan running in PyPI eventually.
That would be excellent. I mean, the big thing with PyPI is the speed. Everyone keeps going on about the speed improvements it can get. Okay, then. So, I mean, what's your kind of future roadmap look like? Where are you going with Mayan, and what's your goals right now?
Well, the feature list for Mayan is 4 pages long, so there's a lot of things that's still to keep adding. But in the short term, the most feature requests are to get it with the kind of plugins and stuff that would allow it to get into more enterprise environments. So a workflow system is in the works, improving the API so that Mayan could be used as a backend document storage. If you don't like the front end, you just build your own. So I would say that those two are the most requested features. And from the day to day, more languages, because sometimes we forget that English is not the only language, and the people actually do want to see software in their own language. So another big item for me is to make the software as translatable. The few strings that are hard-coded, get that out of the way so that it can be 100% translated into any language.
And also, speaking of languages there, and my little pigeon Spanish that I know, did the people that work on Mayan mostly have English as a common language, or is there a variety of people that have no common languages? I guess, well, it'd make it really hard to work on it, but what's the details there?
Well, this was my first internationally successful language project, so getting languages... It was a little bit of a challenge. For example, I have a good Russian programmer, Sergey Glita, speaks very little English, no Spanish at all. Getting technical help to him for him to translate the software was a very big challenge and a very good learning experience. Made me realize that you have to get out of your little language bubble and just get out there and start learning a little bit, a few things, at least enough to get yourself understood by other people. Italian was also a big hurdle for me, because even though Spanish is a romantic romance language, I had no idea and zero Italian knowledge, and Mayan is very big in Italy. So I had to actually start learning a little bit of Italian to get technical specs for them. Another big thing was Arabic, right to left languages, Hebrew and Arabic. I realized that I had those two also. I was discriminating against them unconsciously by hard coding my print statements with languages, with words in the left and numbers and variables on the right. So that also took a little bit of thought to be more judicious when doing my text outputs statements. But all in all, it was a very big experience, and I got to learn a language or two also out of it.
Cool, yeah. And is the code itself written in English or Spanish or some mix of all sorts of languages?
No, the code internally is all English. Programming languages were made to work with English. So every string in itself is natively in English. One of the things that might change in the future is to completely remove English language statements and replace all the output strings with the literals. So there is no ambiguity of how to translate a statement in Maya in the future. Most GNU software actually is coded like that.
Interesting. And you got a lot of features you want to release. What sort of needs do you have? What kind of people are you looking for to help you out?
Well, developers, really. Python developers could really help me a lot. People the Triton developers with experience with enterprise-grade software testing, unit testing is also a big need, and functional testing are things that I really need a lot of help with, because Mayan has some 135 views. So unit testing is a very functional testing before, after every patch is a very intensive work. Mm-hmm. Documentation. The current documentation is 80 pages long and just scratches the surface. So that's another big thing I could really help. I use a lot of help.
Awesome. And I just have to wonder, given the name of the software, did you have any glitches on December 21st?
No, that was actually, I managed to spin that up and use it as a good promo for the software, Mayan EDMS, the only software that will guarantee your documents might not perish after the end of the world.
That's cool. So I've been counting down to that date for a long time. I actually stood about 2 feet from the actual freeze where that number is mentioned down in the Copan. Down in Central America. So I remember that very closely. Yeah, very high. On all my tours, I get to go to all these really cool archaeological places. So that's one of the things I've actually, they wouldn't let you touch it, but it was like right there. It was like right, I was like that far from it. This is really cool. Is it there? And they told me it said December 21st, 2012, but I couldn't tell. It's just some random time there. Anyway, we're just about out of time, but I want to know if there's any questions we didn't ask you that you want to answer anyway.
Well, there's a lot of issues with people who doesn't understand licensing, and there's a lot of debate about which license is better than this one. And my final comment, my final contribution, I wanted to be that really think things through. Try to be as open and free as possible. It actually pays off in the end. Mm-hmm. I know I had a big copyright fight with Mayan a few months back, and the decision of going GPL from the beginning actually saved the project from being sequestered by people in other countries where U.S. copyright law didn't apply.
Interesting. Great. Well, I really appreciate your comments today. I what you're doing is admirable, and I'm glad you sidestepped the status quo and got open source software and free software into the Puerto Rican government. That sounds like a really great model that other people can apply as well. And I really welcome you. Thank you for being on the show and talk about Mayan EDMS. Thanks.
Thanks, Guy. It was my pleasure being here.
Very good. Very good. That was Roberto Rosario, who is the head honcho for Mayan EDMS. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, really, really interesting project. And I think, like you, I was quite shocked by, well, not shocked, but I was amazed by the story that he gave about how he managed to get this stuff into the government, which is really inspiring for a lot of people. Because I think there's a lot of backlash, you know, people still in a lot of large organizations, people very resistant to change. And, you know, anything that's not a big proprietary solution from a big international company, they don't want to know. It's amazing stuff that you managed to get that in there and, you know, start to make policy as well. Incredible.
That is really awesome. And I'm almost embarrassed for the U.S. government and the proprietary interests that keep things locked in here in my own home country, because I travel all over the world and I see how open source software has really influenced the whole communities and development and things like that. And maybe if it's in the Puerto Rican government, maybe it'll slowly sort of eke into the rest of the U.S. government. But I'm not counting on that anytime soon. So maybe I'll just move to Puerto Rico. That'll be easier that way. That way I can just say, hey, now my government is open source. I think I can go there. I go there without a passport, right? It's sort of part of the U.S., but it's not really. It's sort of weird. Yeah. Anyway, yes, U.S. Okay. officials cleared us when we arrived there from another country. So, yeah, I guess it is part of it. Oh, no, that was in St. Thomas. Okay. Well, whatever. I'm shows you how much else I know. Anything else before we move on?
No, I just thought it was a fantastic project, and it sounds really powerful as well. When he was talking about things like actual, you know, managing paper documents as well, still, that was quite surprising. I wasn't expecting that. So, incredible project.
Yeah, I wanted to see if it was more than just things we ski on, because there's so much paperwork, especially the government. Of all the groups to come up with something like this, it would have to be the government, actually, or probably some hospital or something. Either way, it would probably be the good thing there. Speaking of upcoming guests, next week we have The Maker, which is a content management system. It's developed for Macs, but it's all open source. I'm going to be playing with it a little bit. I actually got a code to download it for free for me. But you can build it from source anyway, so I don't know why it gave me a code, but there you go. Web2 project following that is a business-oriented project management system. Looks really cool. It's kind of like Gantt charts and spreadsheets and resource management, kind of like Microsoft Project, but open source and all web-based, all that sort of cool thing. Just to add to the schedule, we have Serenity for Android. It's a Plex media server client for tablets and Google TV devices. So that'll be interesting, talking to somebody about Plex as applied to the Google projects. And then Ansible Works, which is a deployment software, sort of like Puppet or Chef or CF Engine or something, but being used in very, very large scale projects. I had not heard about it until I got the request to have them on the show. So I'm going to be really looking forward to that, because I knew about the other ones already. So that's cool. We're still trying to get more people into Q3. I'm sending out emails all the time to try to fill out those slots. You can go to twit.tv/floss and see the big spreadsheet linked from there to see how well I'm doing getting those slots filled. And if you have a project that's not on that list, or you have one of the projects way down at the bottom, please email the project leader and have them email me. Say, tell them how much you like Floss Weekly and why they should be on the show. And that sounds better coming from one of you guys than from me. So that's kind of why I'm doing this, why I'm crowdsourcing all these guests, because when one of my audience, like you all, are listening, talk to a project leader, they go, oh man, that must be cool. Otherwise, I'm just like I'm selling the project. Okay, you can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google+, and also at Floss Weekly on both Identica and Twitter. We also have a live chat. We took, I think, one or two questions from live chat this time. And that's at live.twit.tv. We tape normally at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. Sometimes it's a slight variation of that, but go to the spreadsheet and you'll have the exact timing on that. You can also follow me at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, but more likely you'll find more interesting stuff about me on Google+. That's at Randall L. Schwartz on Google+. For example, you might have discovered on there that I've been obviously losing a lot of weight on my low-carb, high-fat program. I just want to say that a little shout-out. I just heard from Mom the other day. She started this program 4 months ago and has lost 32 pounds already and two dress sizes. And both Mom and I had never had success in my entire adult life at losing weight. So this is really an amazing thing. And she is so excited about this, too. It's been really amazing. So nothing much to report upcoming. Oh, I'm also going to be gone for a couple weeks on a cruise in Europe. But my lovely co-host will take over for me. So I'm sure the show will continue on. Speaking of my lovely co-host, Dan, what do you want to plug today?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I haven't lost any weight. I can't claim that. So you never know. Maybe I'll have to try the diet as well. I just kind of all lost my power of speech there. Go and check out damage.org, which is on the, if you're watching the video, it's on the lower third there. That's where my blog is. And I'm currently experimenting with things such as moving away from Google services on my Android phone. I'm trying to get onto running my own email and stuff, which I'm sure everyone listening to this probably already does, because you're far more clever than I am. And also check out Linux Outlaws, which is the weekly show that I do with my co-host. And you can find that at sixgun.org. I'm even wearing the t-shirt, though it's slightly off the screen there. Six Gun Productions. If you go to sixgun.org, you can find that and other shows there. And come and find me on Twitter and all those other kind of places, Google+, and so on. It's all linked from danlynch.org.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Dan, once again, thanks for being our co-host, asking interesting and wonderful questions, and even whispering in my ear occasionally about questions I should ask. Really appreciate that.
It's always a pleasure.
Very good, Dan. And we'll see you guys all again. We'll see next you all. English order, please. We'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.